I acknowledge that we stand on Whadjuk Noongar land, land that was never ceded. And we acknowledge the elders past, present and emerging of that land. Our land that is their land. So this is the next in my series of having a look at tricky texts from Hebrew scripture. There's a lot I could say about Job, but that's my entry point because it's come up as part of one of the texts people requested. So thank you to those who requested Job, and particularly this introduction to Job as the text from Hebrew scriptures you find tricky. The nature of Job is to answer, to raise rather than answer questions. So I hope that my talk honours that today. I also want to acknowledge that I speak out of a place of relative comfort and ease. And most of you here have lived through more significant suffering than I have. And in that sense, I am deeply unqualified to speak about Job and to speak about a text about suffering. So you might need to discard what I say, because I just don't know suffering the way you do. And I acknowledge that. This intro to Job that we read, chapter 1 and 2, sits really uncomfortably with lots of readers, including myself. And I think there's probably two reasons for that. One, it's so unfair. Job is made to suffer for no good reason. And that sits badly with us. And the second reason, I think, is that God looks petty and insecure, callously indifferent to the impacts of God's actions and uncaring about the consequences for the people. Now, if you don't really want to go with me into this story today, I titled the talk God the Gambler, and that's why we have Gamble Responsibly written on the wall behind us. It's not there from a poker night last night. if you don't want to go through Job with me, that's your prompt for today. Does God gamble responsibly with us? Are we making a responsible gamble in having faith in God? You can just sit with that if you'd like to. Job is not presented as historical events. It very nearly starts with once upon a time in terms of the way it's told. It's got the tone of a parable or a folk tale. But even as fiction, it's written to convey a deep truth. And so our discomfort remains. In fact, for me, it's even possibly more uncomfortable as a deep truth folk tale, because if it was historical events, I could dismiss it as it might have been a once-off. But if it's written this way in order to convey some deep truth, then why is it depicting events that are unfair and a God that might be a tyrant? So I'm going to pick up those two objections to this passage, that it's unfair and that God might be a petty tyrant. First of all, the accusation that this depicts things that are unfair. This is really the theme that the whole book of Job picks up and pulls at. Job is often used to address the question, why do bad things happen to good people? But actually the question Job asks is, do bad things happen to good people? That's the cutting edge question of his day. Now we might say, of course they do. But the more you listen today and the more I've sat with it this week, I wonder if actually deep down we don't believe that bad things happen to good people. And that's still a challenge for our faith. Job insists that this is what has happened. Bad things have happened to a good person. And Job's friends insist that cannot be possible. Job must be a bad person. We've got this introduction which sets the scene of a traditional prosperity tale. Job is the most wealthy and the most righteous, and that's not a coincidence, person in his realm. And then we have the Satan enters. Not Satan, the personified prince of darkness, the devil of other traditional pieces, but is specifically the Satan, and he's a very ambiguous character in Job, possibly a servant of God, possibly a kind of devil's advocate character whose job is to ask the hard questions and to identify any weaknesses in the heavenly realm. So Satan is doing the Satan's job when Satan questions whether Job is really righteous or whether Job is just self-serving, whether Job is worshipping God for personal gain. So God removes the personal gain, and Job continues to worship, at least for now. That is not fair. Job did nothing to deserve this. But when we say that is not fair, we are implicitly buying into a cosmic justice system where good people deserve good things and bad people deserve bad things. So if a good person receives bad things, it's not fair. It's violated the rules of cosmic justice. And this is Job's case against God, which he spells out at length over many, many chapters in the arguments with his friends. Job claims his prosperity has been wrongfully taken from him because he is righteous, so he does not deserve to suffer. And when God eventually fronts up, God refuses to call Job innocent or guilty on those terms. Rather, God seems to say those are not the rules of the cosmos. In fact, in chapter 40 at the start, God even says, look, if you can manage to run the world on that system of reward and punishment, even I would worship you. It's at about chapter 40, verse 8, depending on which text you've got, the numbering is slightly different. Says, I would worship you if you could make that work. God is saying, not only does the world not work like that, but it is impossible for the world to work like that. So how do we hold our gut feeling that it's not fair when that gut feeling is revealing to us that we have bought into a reward and punishment ideology? Or do we take the terrifying leap of living in a world where good and bad outcomes are not linked in any way to virtue or evil? Can we feel the not fair and also acknowledge that our understanding of fairness is not how the world works? It's not how God's world works. Just as a slight aside, perhaps one of the things that makes it feel the most unfair to us is the death of the children, that Job and his wife lose all their children. Now, without taking away from the horror of that, we are looking into a different culture and a different tale and a style of folk telling in which the children are presented as part of the signs of Job's prosperity and his blessedness. And we see that through the Old Testament, especially in Proverbs, that your blessedness will be shown by how many children you have. And the two parts that Tricia and Ross read, in the first part, the Satan is given permission to take away all of Job's stuff. Everything external to him that reveals his prosperity, that includes his children. And then the second part, the Satan says, well, people would lose their stuff, but they wouldn't cope with losing the abilities of their body. Go for his body. Now, I think those of us who are parents here would say, we would happily take the sickness in our body if it protected our children. And the fact that that is not the logic that underpins this narrative suggests we're in a very different culture. It doesn't mean that it's not an uncomfortable tale, but it also goes some way to explaining the logic then of why at the end, when there's a scene of Job being restored to prosperity, he gets more children. Now, we all know that when we're talking about individuals and relationships, it's inhumane and callous to say more children would replace the ones you lost. But when we are talking about the imagery of prosperity in their culture, this is an image of prosperity, and that image of prosperity is returned. It doesn't resolve the problem, but I think it gives some context to why it's there. The second accusation is that this text shows God as an insecure tyrant. God seems to have a schoolyard bet with Satan at the expense of Job. It seems like God is just not confident in God's own servants and needs to test if they're really faithful. Now, I think we have to consider two options of how that comes about. Is it that God actually doesn't know whether Job is motivated by true love or by self-service? And so it's not so much a wager or a gamble as a scientific experiment. God is setting up the terms he needs to discover the truth scientifically. The only way to discover motive, if he's acting in terms of what he can get out of it, is to take away the rewards and then we'll see. It's arguably a legitimate question that God needs to resolve if God is not omniscient and doesn't already know. But is it acceptable that God might conduct scientific experiments on God's people to improve God's knowledge? We're left having to say, would we rather have a God who has limited knowledge and runs the world on best guesses and a hope rather than actual truth because God doesn't want to push it to find out? Or would we rather have a God who stops at nothing to determine the truth? The text doesn't answer that question. Or we could say God does know Job's motives. And then we really are in the realm of a wager or a gamble. And the prize is who is right and who is wrong in the court of heaven. Who saves face and who is shamed. In this scenario, God knows all along that Job will be faithful. And the whole scenario is God's way of proving it to someone else, both to the heavenly court and to humans for all time, because the story is passed on to us. It's a way of proving that humans have the capacity to love God for God's own sake. If God is omniscient, then God must take full responsibility for knowingly acting to harm Job. What sort of God needs to prove themselves to their servants, even if it means acting as a tyrant? And what are they proving then to their servants if they act as a tyrant to prove it? Again, these questions are not resolved in the text. They're raised. Why is it that God is unable to respond to the Satan's challenge by saying, well, that is a very interesting question, and we can't possibly know the answer to Job's motives, because to find out would mean to crush Job, or to prove it to you would mean to crush Job, and that's unacceptable, so we won't do it. So we just live with the fact that we don't know. But God doesn't do that. The Satan's challenge is, Job wouldn't worship you if you weren't good to him. But then it becomes, and I think this is where the words of Job's wife fit, Job shouldn't worship you because you are not good to him. Now, some people find comfort in this story because it shows an invisible divine purpose at work in seemingly random events of suffering. But I find it really hard to see a good God there. For me, the idea of an invisible divine purpose in random suffering actually makes it harder. I can live better with random suffering than with some sort of deliberately inflicted pain that God is doing something with. But again, my challenge to see a good God in this links to my notions of what makes a God good. And that tends to circle back around to ideas of protection, prosperity, comfort. Not prosperity in the sense of lots of money, but the sense of there being a goodness that comes to us out of God. And this is exactly what the book of Job is trying to pull apart. Let's take a moment to sit with the discomfort of these images. Or if for you this is a comfort tale, to recognise that it's not a comfort tale for everyone. And listen to the parts of your own story that are being evoked as we talk about these things. In the first two chapters, Job is spoken about by the narrator, and by God and by the Satan. He has very few words attributed to him, and they're all really the narrator's words put into his mouth. So he fits within this imagery of the pious Job. But in chapter 3, Job starts to speak for himself. And then the tone changes dramatically. And this is where other people have found comfort in Job, in this abrasive description of the reality of pain. The remarkable thing to me is that Job's pain is held by Scripture and it's passed on to us as a sacred thing. In that holding of Job's pain, we may perhaps find our pain also held as a sacred thing. Job accuses God of being a tyrant, and God does not defend the charge. And in fact, the speeches from the whirlwind have imagery of chaos and destruction that are part of God's creative force. And the book overall seems to suggest that, yes, God might be a tyrant, but this is the only God we have. And the book also pulls at what our definition of tyrant might be and suggests that tyrant might not be the most relevant framing for thinking about God. Yes, God is a tyrant, if by tyrant we mean one who refuses to operate by the laws of good equals reward and bad equals punishment. Somehow God both nurtures the birthing mountain goats and carefully finds food for the hunting lions who eat mountain goats. Is God a tyrant for allowing lions to eat the young mountain goats? Or is God a tyrant when God lets the lions go hungry because the goats escaped? I've had that poem that Rose read on my mind this week. It was written when I was at uni studying Job. I just had a whole lot of friends have babies right when I was studying Job, including Sarah Petroni, who was born that semester. And something of the tension of that. And this week we've been celebrating Eva turning 12, which is this amazing thing to me. And I've been reading Job, and I've been remembering in prayer my cousin who prepared for her husband's funeral yesterday. And I've been watching the news as the escape flights out of Afghanistan cease. And COVID. God nurtured and loved and sheltered those babies born in 2006 when I was studying Job, but God never promised to protect them. And that poem took on a particular poignancy for me when 4 years later, the younger sister of one of those very babies did not survive. So is God a tyrant? Did God love and nurture that baby less? Did God cease to love and nurture my cousin Greg when the cancer took his body? Did God love the Afghans who made it onto a plane more than the ones who didn't? When it's goats and lions, it seems simple and it's kind of cute. But when it's humans, it's harder to stomach. So the third question I think this text raises, how do we respond? And Job presents a whole range of ways we might respond, especially how we might respond where we discover God is not guaranteed to act for our good. Perhaps, like the Job we've seen in chapters 1 and 2, we will submit to the give and take of God and find comfort in trusting that God is faithfully with us, whatever comes. Now, yesterday I joined the online memorial service for my cousin and her family, and that understanding of the presence of God and the give and take is giving that family comfort right now. And there is no way I would want to undermine or take that away. But I found the funeral really jarring. It is a completely legitimate biblical response to suffering to piously and faithfully accept that God gives and takes. The long dialogues in Job, however, suggest that this is a faithful and legitimate response if it's the response the sufferer finds comfort in. It is not an okay response to dictate to someone else, which is what Job's friends attempt to do, and they get scathingly critiqued. My cousin's son Joel, in his eulogy, said he was at peace with his dad's passing, but he was not okay with losing his dad. Which I found a really helpful comment. Suffering happens, but we don't have to like it. And Job gives us another legitimate biblical response to suffering. Rage. Rage against the unfairness. And at the end of the book, God praises Job for having spoken rightly about God. Now, given that Job has just spent chapter after chapter accusing God of being unjust and a tyrant, that's quite some affirmation from God. It's startling. Is God saying, yes, Job is right to say that God is not a good God? Because he says that. Is he right to say that God doesn't abide by the rules of punishment and reward? Even though Job thinks God should abide by those rules, Job's accusation is God should but doesn't, whereas God's point of view seems to be God doesn't and shouldn't. Or is Job right because he has spoken so honestly and with integrity about his pain? He has spoken rightly. Or perhaps he is right because he has spoken to God, whereas all the other characters speak about God. Job insists on addressing God directly. He insists on relationship rather than theory. And all of those voices appear, multiple voices, with various understandings, and maybe they are all legitimate biblical responses for us. Maybe it's legitimate in response to suffering to say God is not good. Maybe it's to say the categories of good and bad are meaningless when suffering happens. Shit happens. That is a legitimate biblical response to suffering. Maybe it is to respond so that our voice of pain can be heard and to not let others overrule it. Maybe it is to keep telling it to God, as ugly or violent as the words in your heart or coming out your mouth might be, insist that your suffering is God's business. Now, if my talk today has resolved the tensions of Job as a tricky text for you, then I've spoken very poorly. Because Job is intentionally and deliberately disturbing. It sets out to destabilize fundamental understandings of God and of how the world works, and it leaves them unstable. The book's pieces complement each other and also contradict each other, so that there is no one answer to explain Job. The article that I sent with the image of the kind of modernist theatre piece with multiple, not just multiple voices, but multiple ways of telling, I found really helpful in thinking about Job as so many pieces having a go at the same theme in different ways with different conclusions. It challenges our easy answers. It challenges our assumptions that we know how God works. And it leaves us with a very disturbing question of the Satan hanging over us. Are we in it for our own gain, or do we love God for God's self? And very close on the heels of that question is Job's wife's question. If God is, as this book suggests, not a reliable force for our good, is God worthy of our love anyway? This is a question we need to wrestle with, and Job forces us to look at it. For me, personally, God is good, but doesn't guarantee protection. I worded it in that poem, God is a fierce place to reside, and also God is the milk of life pours forth unstoppable. And I don't know how that fits together, I just don't know. But I haven't got a better God available. I've got this God, and this is the God who I can't control with my preconceived ideas. And somehow this God revealed God's self in Jesus and allowed the limitations of humanity to control how God was revealed in that first century Palestinian time and place. That God revealed in Jesus is where I pin my hopes. Knowing full well that I don't really understand and I might well have got it all wrong. Can I love God not for personal gain? My honest answer is no. So where I land is with the words of Teresa of Avila, a prayer that I've found really helpful over lots of years as a guide and a comfort. And she says, I do not love God. I do not want to love God. But I want to love God. And I've managed remarkably to finish in time for questions. Yes. So, would anyone like to question or comment?
When I was a very young Christian, I read a book called Tortured for Christ.
I wondered if I was in a circumstance where I was going to be tortured if I did not retract my faith in Christ, whether I would be able to hang in there. But then it also brings to mind many, many people who have been tortured, burned at the stake, roasted, all sorts of horrendous things that have happened to Christians because they would not let go of their faith.
Mm.
So they were actually suffering because of their faith.
Mm.
This was actually sparked by your question, would you love God if God wasn't good to you?
Mm.
So the flip side is, would you still love God if it turned out you were actually going to suffer for the fact that you love God?
Mm. Yeah.
It still haunts me, and I still have great admiration for the people who have been able to hang in there and endure being burned and roasted and all sorts of other tortures.
Mm.
So that's sort of the next step down the suffering scale, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways this does present Job as the one tortured for Job's faith. It's just the disturbing factor is that God is the torturer, not some human agent who's opposing God.
One of the things that occurred to me, because I actually read some of this morning, most rarely, is that I used to have a problem with all the things that happened to Job falling upon him in one day, as it were. And it occurred to me that's what's happened to a lot of refugees, is that they could actually lose everything in a day, just like that.
Mm.
And for some of them, it's a case of they don't know where their family is, and they're either later reunited or find they died. Or in other cases, they see them killed before their eyes and they lose their home and so forth. I mean, we knew people from Bosnia who hadn't lost their immediate family, but they'd lost everything. And they were people who had quite a lot before the calamity fell on them.
Yeah.
And, of course, they came here and made a new life for themselves, as indeed you could say, like the Job restoration narrative in the end. And in fact, indeed, one family who did have a child after they came here, though they didn't lose any of their earlier children. So in that sense, I suppose it makes it more believable that those things can still happen to people and are happening now in Afghanistan and in other places in the world.
Yeah. Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you for your integrity and your clarity. I really appreciate that. And just to share, if it wasn't for Job and his good mate Ecclesiastes, I wouldn't be sitting here today because, interestingly enough, although Job is a fictional account, it lifts Christianity out of fairy tale status for me, and it just does it for me. And just one last thing is what I've accepted is I suffer, as we all do, from parallax error, i.e. from my position here on the planet, I just can't see it at the angle that makes sense. But I trust that on the other side of life, there will be that resolution of parallax error.
Thanks, Ken.
I just got one question. Would just the book of Job, this particular picture of God, be more compatible with one of the Christianities that got stomped on, particularly Gnosticism, where this is the demiurge, the noble deity, the tyrant? In this case?
I think there's not one consistent image of God in Job. So, like many other things, you can pick pieces of Job that you can use to support Gnosticism or anything else, but you can also pick pieces of Job that would contradict exactly the same thing. So that's part of Job, is that it's very deliberately not giving you one neat answer that'll give you a dogma.
you've brought back so many memories for me of also studying Job. And one of my enduring images is that Job went and sat in a particular place, and it was the bit, the rubbish heap where people threw their broken pottery. And the thing he picked up, the pot shard, was also what people would write on, almost like a scapegoat, their bad things, and chuck them away. Oh. Now, Job picked one of those up to scrape himself with. So this kind of complex Jewish way of telling a story with all these lovely layers, this image in Job of him deliberately going to the rubbish heap, picking up a pot shard with accusations and bad things written on it to scrape himself with it, to me speaks of his desire to get to the guts of the story. And I don't know, I guess I see him as a very active, and he wants to go through the pain of finding out things. So it's not just a kind of a whining voice. It's an engaging in a process thing where he really wants to get somewhere with this. And I really honour that in Job.
Thanks, Jenny. All right, I'll hand it back to Bevan. Thank you.